This is side two, tape 361, November 3rd, 1978. You notice I'm playing the song Tomorrow from Annie. There's always tomorrow. I got out to the American Airlines early in the morning. This car had followed me to the airport, and I checked in at down below and got a seat number, checked my baggage through out to Monterey and Carmel area, San Francisco, Monterey. And when I went up to board the plane, when it was time to board the plane, they looked at my slip and said, no, you can't take this plane. Your flight's been canceled. And I said, canceled? I was screaming and yelling. They said, yes, somebody canceled your reservation. And it's a long story. I was just simply furious, and I stood by to see who was taking the seats. They said, well, get out of the way. It was a big, I think, a DC-10, a huge plane coming out from New York to San Francisco, packed with people. And I stood there, and two men with black gloves, black hats, they looked like the typical kind of an espionage thing, just walked through. I looked at them and figured these could only be the people. There were no families, and they didn't look like regular travelers that walked through. And I went downstairs to the desk and screamed and yelled, and they said they gave my ticket to a person from, they said, the Admiral's Club. If you've gone, I don't know how many thousand miles, 30, 60,000 miles by air, or how many, you automatically get a seat, and they gave it. And I was simply furious. I'd been followed out to the airport, and they said there wouldn't be any more tickets till after Christmas. And I said, oh, no. And yeah, I was yelling and screaming, and they told me that somebody just came, actually just bounced me, and believe me, they had me on the next flight coming to San Francisco. I was so furious. It was in April of 76, just before that, when I was going to Dayton, Ohio to speak university there. I was transferring in Chicago, and our plane took off from San Francisco, and it was circling Chicago for a while, and then we were told that there were ambulances below and fire engines and so forth, that we may have difficulty landing, that a wheel had come off the airplane. They didn't know if it was one wheel or two wheels, and they'd gone under the bottom of the plane to see. There's some kind of a glass thing, evidently, that they could look under, and they weren't sure how much damage, but in flight, the wheel or wheels had come off, and luckily we made a landing. Of course, the ending was happy, but they didn't know what condition we'd be able to land, and we were circling there till everything else. And you can imagine O'Hare Airport, I think it's the busiest airport in the United States, just filled with planes, and everything had to clear and make way for a possible hazardous landing, and we did okay. I took a trip in May of 76, another trip to New York City from San Francisco, United Airlines, and on that trip I had my luggage locked, because after the one from New Orleans where everything was taken, I figured I would know at least if it was open. And again, the locks two different times have been completely ripped off my suitcase, and the material is just thrown around. I carry all books or documents or anything I'm going to lecture about. Never after the New Orleans trip in 67 did I ever even put a magazine article in with my clothing. What I ship through is just clothing, and that's it. And everything else is in my hand, even though it's heavy to lug around, because twice, two different times, the locks were off my suitcases and all the clothing was just scattered and dispersed. In the trip of from Sacramento to San Francisco in April, the one before the airplanes came off and the wheels came off going to Chicago, I was speaking in Sacramento, and I don't usually like to time it that close. I was in Sacramento one day, like Wednesday to Thursday, and I had to come home Thursday morning because to catch the plane then to go east. It was too close together. But as luck would have it, I go out to the airport always 1 hour to 2 hours before my plane leaves. I like to get there. I like to check in. I like to read the magazines and see what's on the stands and see the people and see what's going on. And as I got to the airport in San Francisco and mentioned I was going to United Airlines, in another hour or hour and a half, they said that plane is defective. It won't fly till the next morning. And there was a PSA right in the airport ready to take off. And I just ran down with my books and material and ran through the aisle and got on the PSA and got to Monterey all right. And the clothing didn't matter what I had in Sacramento, but I got on the PSA flight that was leaving just at the time I was at the airport. Otherwise, I would have missed the entire New York trip, which maybe would have been okay, but it happened that way. And then short while after that, again, I was in Sacramento, leaving Sacramento. I'd spoken at Consumers River College in Sacramento. I'd been in different colleges in Sacramento talking up there. And we were on an airplane that dropped several thousand feet, and there was no turbulence or indication of air. It was at least 1,000 feet that this plane dropped. And I just held on to the arm of the person next to me and thought, okay, this is it. It's just going straight down. And the first thing that flashed to my mind, it's funny what you think about, but I always take maximum insurance. I just take a whole pocket full of quarters. And I figure, well, if I go, at least my kids will have some money from it, you know. And so I take out the maximum, 150,000, whatever it is in that machine. I pile up quarters before I travel. So if the plane goes down, at least they have a little nest egg of something they can use. And the plane was dropping. I thought, well, at least the kids have some, they're taken care of in a sense. And some security. I got all this insurance for them. But the plane didn't crash. It just dropped. And then I called Federal Aviation, went back to the airports. A Miss Sandoval from Hughes Air West took care of it. I have her San Mateo number here. A Mr. Bryant called the passengers and said, send any medical bills. There was a Bob Northey, the supervisor. I tried to follow up. I have the names of all the people. No one would tell us which airplane was coming at us. It was a plane. It was a near collision. They wouldn't say who was flying it. They wouldn't say who owned the plane. I want to know who the pilot was and who owned the airplane that went out, that was coming to us where our pilot saw it and averted a collision. And there is no way, even though I was on that airplane and a passenger on the plane and they were concerned about any possible physical damage to the people, they would never reveal the name of the airline or who was in control of that airplane. I think that's interesting. The secrecy of that, because I've mentioned on the tapes a couple of weeks ago my concern about Lieutenant Dimely, our Lieutenant Governor Dimely, Merv Dimely, running against Mike Curb and the airplane crash, that jetliner, Pacific Southwest airliner in San Diego. And there are articles on that airline just this last October 26th in the San Jose Mercury and the San Francisco Chronicle. And the San Francisco Chronicle has a story that the PSA pilot struggled to save the plane, and they said what the PSA pilot failed to report. That's the San Francisco coverage of this article. But the San Jose Mercury has the coverage the same day, and this is why it's important to take two different newspapers. It says, pilot struggled desperately to save the PSA plane, and then it mentions that in the cockpit, when they lost sight of the Cessna plane that was coming to them, was a man named Anthony Poli, a co-pilot for the Flying Tiger Airlines. And I might have mentioned that to you before on a tape. I don't remember. But I would like to know if the Flying Tiger airline was coming at us when I left Sacramento or not. But I will never know. Also, as on American Airline in Chicago, this is in October of 76, October the 5th, we went to check in. I'd been east, went to Chicago, coming back to Monterey, and the plane was to be checked in at 1 o'clock. We were told, come back at 2. We came back at 2. They said, go to another gate. They said, go to 8H or HK, which at O'Hare is really not easy. The aisles separate. The numbers were off. And they said the plane was defective. The one we were on was not taking off. It was defective, such as like the Sacramento plane I was supposed to take in April 76. That was a United. This was an American airline. And so they had to bring in another plane and change all the luggage and change all the meals and transfer us around O'Hare Airport. And it took hours. And they put us on another plane. So twice planes were defective. And that's one of the reasons I really don't enjoy flying unless I have to. Now, even though things come off of the car, I feel more secure on the ground. In September of 76, I was working on a book about Howard Hughes. I had been working since the summer with Don Steiny, a young student who was going to University of California at Santa Cruz, and he's back there now. We were doing an article about Don Bowles, the reporter from Arizona, who was blown up because my research in investigation went into the Howard Hughes organization. When he died, or when he was blown up, John Bowles used the word Emprise, which is a syndicate group with headquarters in Buffalo and Detroit and New York. And I had reason to believe enough to write an article with Don about the Bulls-Howard Hughes connections. You see, the body that was supposed to be Hughes had been turned in April 76, and Bowles had often written about organized crime, and they'd never blown him up. But he had information about land swindles in Arizona, and I believe it involved the Montreal Stock Exchange and the market and the Hughes organization. And so when Hughes was dead, I think Bowles felt safe to put in this information, and he was blown up. And we were doing this article, and I'd gone up to San Francisco to see The Wiz and came home, and there was a message about Don Steiny. He had been in a car accident. There were three people in the car, a man who was driving, a young person, they were in their 20s, who was drunk, another young person who I just saw this week in town in Monterey and talked with him, whose father works for the FBI, who he was injured mildly but left town the next day and took a powder, and Don. Incidentally, the driver of the car that Don Steiny was injured in and almost killed in is now in Germany. The fellow that was thrown out of the car with them told me that he went back to Germany, and he's living there now. Don had a massive brain injury. He had three brain surgeries, and he had a shank put in his neck. It's there now to drain fluid from the brain and neck, take off the fluid from the brain. He was left legally blind. We had to stop all work on the Howard Hughes book, and he's teaching now and taking courses at the University of California. Even though he can't see, he's very, very bright. He could just see a tiny bit. He has just a tiny little vision, and he's taking special classes up at the University of Santa Cruz. He has a tremendously high IQ and is a good counselor with young people and underprivileged people. But that's when my book on Howard Hughes just really came to a halt. He went through, as I say, several surgeries, and it was really hard to go back to community hospital and see your coworker laid up like that. Shortly after, this was in September of 76, when he was left blind, our next-door neighbor, Andy Parsons, had a car accident. We never will know what happened there. He was driving a car, and his girlfriend and several others were in the car. Three people were killed. One was left paralyzed. He's up, and he walks now with braces and wonderful treatment, but he was almost dead, on the brink of death for days. And this was 3 months after Don Steiny's accident that several people close to my family and my daughters were involved. Two close friends of Diane's were killed in this accident, and Andy was almost killed, and one was left permanently handicapped and with braces and so forth, which ended his acting career for the most part. It altered his life, and that was right next to us here. That was in 1976. And also in November of 76, my ex-husband, the father of my three girls, was driving Los Angeles, and he had a car which burst into flames. He doesn't know why. He lives in Westwood and was going to the store in Beverly Hills, and he's one of the means of my support. He supports me and the children. And Bill's car was just literally destroyed. It just blew up in flames and was destroyed, where mine was in flames and I was near water and it was put out. That car just went up in flames and was totally destroyed, but he got out on time and jumped out and was all right. In the fall of 1977, I went down to Los Angeles to do that movie, The Howard Hughes Mystery, with Manuel Zecina. There was an article in July, it was July 16th, 1977, in the newspaper about producer Manuel Zecina, Z-E-C-E-N-A, and it's written by John Austin. It said, producer Manuel Zecina, who turned down more than $2 million from investors wanting to back his new completed movie, The Howard Hughes Mystery, is digging in his pocket for his next two films. He's made 27 movies previously in Latin America. Zecina asked me to make the opening and the closing and six scenes in The Howard Hughes Mystery, which I did, and then after he sent the film to the lab to be developed, the FBI and members of the CIA came to Zecina. They had the soundtrack of the movie. Parts of the movie were thrown away and destroyed. The movie was shelved for 1 year, and when he felt the pressure was off and determined to do it again, we shot the film over again this last June. It still isn't out, although I spoke to Manuel recently, and he thinks that they will be getting the movie out, and we have an introduction, but many of the scenes, again, were cut up on the cutting room floor and were mangled and are not available, and I don't think we'll film those for the third time. I think Manuel and I have gotten the message. I was going to make this film. He wanted the photographic copies of the correspondence I did with Clarence Kelly of the FBI, and I think way back on tapes earlier, I talked about the fact that my house was burglarized, that my correspondence with FBI Director Clarence Kelly that was on my desk for purposes of taking down to film the movie was taken. I called the Justice Department in Washington, and they sent out within the next, by 10 in the morning, I called Washington, and in the afternoon at my house were teletype copies of my correspondence with what I wrote to Clarence Kelly and what he wrote to me, but without his signature on. Either it was his letters before he signed it that the FBI keeps records of, or they use some kind of ink to erase his name. But the film was to use the correspondence of Clarence Kelly, and we talk about the burglarizing of my house in the film, but the letters that I have now, the copies of the original letters, do not have the signature of FBI Director Clarence Kelly. There was a gentleman named Charles I. Spiesel, S-P-I-E-S-E-L, an insurance salesman that Jim Garrison had wanted to testify at his trial when he had arrested Clay Shaw for part of the conspiracy to kill John Kennedy. And by the time Spiesel was able to testify, he had been hypnotized 50 or 60 times, and he had been followed by the New York Red Squad, and he had been made to sound so unbelievable and so crazy that instead of being a reliable witness that saw Lee Harvey Oswald at Clay Shaw's apartment when he went down there at a party, he became the laughingstock of the testimony and was discredited. And I think often that many of the things that are happening to me are to make stories unbelievable, capers that I can talk about that are happening recently, and one that happened just a couple of years ago. I call it the mouse caper. I call it my little CIA mouse caper. And I think of some things that happened to Mr. Spiesel and wonder about those. I was sitting in the living room with Barbara one evening, and we heard footprints outside by the grass. The curtains were closed, and we heard somebody walking, and both of us were scared. And I quickly closed the curtains the other part of the house around from the living room, and we were there alone, and as I say, we heard these footprints. We opened the curtain to see what was there, and all we saw was a mouse looking at us, standing there looking at us, and we got hysterical because I think it's hard to hear a mouse outside the window, and we thought they were human footprints or sounds. And after that, the next day, our garage and my study, where I kept a lot of my research, had an invasion of mice, and there was also a mouse in my car, and I'd park, and a mouse would run across the dashboard, and he was eating the seating of the car, and I couldn't catch the little bastard. And there were mice, and you can imagine how nice that is to eat newspapers or research or get into the house, our garage and back where I stored things. We had an invasion of mice, and I used to always call them my CIA mice, because whenever we would try to catch these mice, they were very visible, and they would look at us. And just recently, we had a spate of another generation of them. We got rid of all of them, and we have cats, and we had exterminators and so forth. And finally, this one mouse in the car got baked out up in Sacramento weather. I got caught in a wheel or something. I went up there, and it was very hot. And I took the car to the Dodge place to have it, looked over to see how in the world he got in or what I could do about this thing. Driving up there and being in the car and having a mouse running back and forth the car was really driving me bananas. And there wasn't much they could do or to figure out how in the heck he got into this car. But I had to live with it for a while. But recently, just last winter, we're not having mice right now, there was a whole spate of five or six incidences where these mice would be in the kitchen, and one would stand next to the refrigerator and shelf and look at me, and just stand there and look. And I take a plate and just put it over his head and put a cookie sheet under it and take him away. And I can catch these mice by hand. It's almost like they're drugged or stupid. They stand and look at me, and I make my own little trap with a box and just take them away. And they're totally unafraid to be around me or the cats. And I just, as a joke, call them my CIA mice for no other reason, because I don't know anybody else who has experiences like this. But when it all started was when we heard the footprints and heard a person outside, and then the next morning we had these experiences. I also came home one day and had my neighbor, Charles Winnan, with a friend who had material or instruments to put an antenna on top of my house. And I said, what is that for? He worked at Stanford in the science department or engineering, electric department. And the reason for the antenna was that I could hear FM in San Francisco. And I said, don't put anything on my house. This is the same Charles Winnen that has Melvin Belli as his attorney who's suing Paul Krasner and the Rolling Stone magazine because of the Manson article that Krasner wrote. And I said, look, if you want to bug my house or put antennas, do it when I'm not home or put on the window seals or stake it outside. But for God's sakes, don't just stand there and attach them while I'm watching. I didn't ask you to come. I don't want you to come. I think it's a lot of nerve for you to just get up my roof and put it up there in clear daylight or want to do it. So I asked them to please leave. They were in the living room, and please leave and leave me alone. And if they're going to do it, don't let me know it because I don't want to look at it. But I almost was the recipient of an antenna on my roof that was very open. I also was down at the same Charles Winnen's house one day talking to him and Carolyn, and the phone rang. And he hung up, and he mentioned who it was. It was a friend from Los Angeles, and this friend had an appointment to meet Sirhan Sirhan's brother, or had just met him. And his brother was shot on the Los Angeles freeway. He was all right, and he lived, but he was shot at the freeway. And the party that he was supposed to be with to meet, or had just been with, had just called Charles Winnen's house and told him about the incident of Sirhan Sirhan's brother. They were in touch, these people in Los Angeles, with the Sirhan family and with the same Charles Winnen who had brought the party from Stanford to put the antenna. This same party built a crib for Winnen's baby, Carlotta. It was a electronic crib. If the baby cried, the crib automatically started to rock. He was into electronics and worked at Stanford. The latest incident to happen, I'm jumping now because I'm almost to 77, I may not have time for all this on the tape, is what I call the garbage caper, and I think about Charles Pizell, and I don't really know what to make of it. There's a certain amount of dogs in our neighborhood, and they've been there all along. There's no new dogs, and I have one dog and two cats, and I know the neighborhood pretty well. I've been here 4 years. In the last 2 weeks, I have been subjected to what I call the garbage caper, that every time the garbage is out at night or put there, it's thrown all over the ground, and I have to go out, and I don't know if it's an animal. Some people suggested there's an animal other than the dogs getting it, but it's steady. So now I got new lids to garbage cans, and I take my car at night and I pull it head on so that it backs up to the garbage cans, and then I have a contraption to hold a wire post thing that holds it both to the wall and the car bumper to see that my garbage stands still. And I thought that was pretty neat. I have a Rube Goldberg contraption because I'm tired of going out and picking up all this garbage that come once a week. So yesterday I went up to San Jose to do a radio show up there in the evening from 8 to 10 and spent the day at a bookstores up in San Jose, used bookstores, getting some books, and locked my house, locked the doors, and came home at night. And when I went in the front door, there was garbage all over the living room. What was under the sink hadn't been emptied, and it was all over the kitchen and hall, and the dogs and cats had a ball. I should have put it out, but I didn't want to lift the lids outside, and the whole living room was strewn. Now, it may be that my cat opened the garbage section under the sink, or my dog did that, but it would be the first time they ever did it, and it's an unusual thing, and it isn't even important to spend your time. There's so many earth-shattering events coming on that I even feel guilty spending the time. And yet, to talk about various things that are happening, and we'll be going next week for the next 2 or 3 weeks into I.G. Farben and the selection of popes and the Vatican and the fascism and Vatican and Adolf Hitler and American Wall Street and Vatican, and I'm doing work night and day on that. But on the other hand, I think you should know with some of the things I'm living with as they're happening, because they are happening and they're weird, and I just want to share them with you. One evening I came home to type, and I had pictures of my five children right in front of my typewriter, tacked right to the wall here in front of that I look up sometimes and see their faces. And there were some high school pictures of Bonnie and Barbara, and Diane was in grammar school at the time of the accident 7 years ago. And one evening I was typing, and I looked up, and the picture of Bonnie, the daughter that was killed in 1970, was slashed with a knife. The whole face and forehead was just torn. The picture was still taped to the wall. None of the other pictures were taped, and I just practically had a heart attack. I almost fainted. I looked up, and her face was just cut through. And it's just a terrible thing to come home and feel really optimistic, feeling good, good about yourself and your friends and your life, and just to look up there and know that there's no way, there's no cat, dog, or way that that picture could just be torn the way it was and sliced right through the face. And somebody knows how to get to me. They really do. And that's the part I want to share with you now, in addition to all the other research, is that there are those private moments where these things are happening. I won't do any more tapes on it, maybe an update a year from now, but I think you get the idea that it isn't all wine and roses, that I have my private moments that I don't put on the tape that are happening a lot of the time. There are things happening now with my daughter, Barbara. She's going with somebody who worked for Clement Stone 5 years. His brother's on the Dallas Police Department. I mentioned it on other tapes. I feel that she's under some kind of a control. I could do a whole tape on it. I don't want to do it. And Diane also is beginning to act really peculiar. I don't want to dwell with this with you people. I have to watch it, but it's on my mind, and it's what I'm living with now. Barbara was in a play down at the Wharf. She's studying acting, and she was in a play, Little Night Music, and there was a gentleman in the play named Ken Crockett who was in the play, and he took her out, and they spent about 4 days together, and he came and to the house with her. They were in love, and he said that he was going to marry her and get her this beautiful house and take care of her forever, and they were madly in love. I asked him where he worked, and he said he worked insurance salesman for 5 years. He was divorced and has a child, but he decided to drop out and do acting. And so I got very suspicious of this person. I asked him who he worked for, and he said he worked, for Clement Stone. In The Realist in 1973, my story, The Senate Select Committee's Part of the Cover-Up, I wrote, W. Clement Stone contributed nearly $7 million to the Republicans since 1968, and I felt this provided the one... He said, in quotes, this is Clement Stone, this provided the one chance in a lifetime to change the course of history for the better. The feeling of necessity and desperation he expressed was translated into better business, and that he gave money to the Republican Party, millions and millions of dollars that was used for their dirty tricks. When the airplane crash came of Dorothy Hunt, she was investigated at the United Airlines in Chicago by a gentleman who later went on to be paid full-time from Clement Stone. The Secretary of the White House, Dwight Chapin, worked for Richard Nixon. He went to United Airlines at the time of the investigation. He was paid a full salary while he was in jail at the Watergate affair, and then went on to be paid by Clement Stone. Ken worked for Stone 5 years and came out with A Jesus Freak, a man heavy into religion and the Christian religion, and was brought out to California by this person. He had no office, no telephone number, no box number. He was living in a little room like a zombie. I was afraid that he had drugged Barbara. He was given a $4,000 loan by a man named Bud Allen in town. He is kept at a woman's house. Her name is Peggy Barb in Pebble Beach, and she gave him a car. He has no accountability, no office. He hasn't worked, and Barbara is still with him after 18 months. She's still going with him. They played together in West Side Story. I don't trust him, and I have not allowed him in the property, but I'm going to, in fact, I'm meeting them today. I'm going to meet Barbara and Ken. I feel that to be disassociated from it is too dangerous, and that I have to play a more friendly or open line, because it's gone on so long and it's impossible to fight it head on. I've gone to the FBI, the local police, and written to the Treasury Department. The man has paid no taxes, federal taxes of any kind. He's a non-person in terms of investigations. People have tried to look into his background and past. There's no high school degree, college degree, income tax. He's living here, and he has thoroughly seduced Barbara into believing, or trying to make himself believable, and it's a collision course which has been hanging over our family here for the last 18 months. I look at a notebook here. It's called May, and I sometimes think, instead of writing about Lee Harvey Oswald or some of these earth-shaking events, it would be interesting to just write the story of my childhood from Beverly Hills to Carmel and the things that have happened in the course of seeing fascism appear in my lifetime, not knowing anything about it when I went to Stanford. They never talked about it, from 1940 to 43 at Stanford or in Beverly Hills High School. And just write the experiences, the good things, the people I've met, the wonderful, beautiful people, the marvelous experiences I've had, the positive things and the sad things and the threats and the crazy things and the one-time things that only happened to me and nobody else. I sometimes think, or I don't think they do, maybe we should get them down, and they're happening to everybody, and nobody is able to express them or say them or communicate them because they think they're too crazy to share. You know, it's like when I talk about the garbage keeper, you'll read later in counterintelligence programs how they distributed garbage or dropped rattlesnakes like the snake in our tent up in Canada or the acid the Marvin got in 67. It seems that I'm more able to talk about these things and open, and then years later you read that they did, in fact, happen to other people in exactly the same way by the same people causing them to happen. I do think sometimes that it would be interesting to write about these experiences and get out some facts about the assassinations of what I was doing at the time all this was coming down. Well, next week we get back to the Pope, the Farben, and some major cataclysmic events in history.